What's up, people? Welcome back to another episode of Kickoff Sessions Podcast by your host, me, Darren Lee. And on this episode, episode 31, I'm joined by Bernard Walsh. Bernard is head of pensions and investments in Bank of Ireland Investment Markets. He's worked in pensions and investment related roles in Bank of Ireland for over 15 years. Before that, he's also worked in Ulster Bank Markets, Barclays Bank and Permanent TSB. The idea for today is all around financial literacy, financial well-being and improving our knowledge of finance as a whole. Whether it's managing your own pension funds, looking at investment strategies and trying to build something that is more personal to yourself, I want to sit down with Bernard to understand some of the structures in this. When it comes to pensions, it's not exactly something that's very topical for young people. They don't put that much value into it, and probably because we're thinking too far ahead for something like pensions. And it's often led to people not really understanding the value in it and also not really wanting to put away money for it. So the idea for today was to sit down with Bernard, who has so much experience working in pensions, to understand the nitty-gritty of why we should be doing it and what value it poses for the future for us. We look at several different areas around pensions. We look at the value in doing it, the tax schemes that are available to us for doing it, among many other different areas. Then I question Bernard on investments and how to build an all-weather portfolio, how to look at different ways to line up the market that suits your own risk appetite. That's the whole purpose of this. There is no investment advice given by Bernard or myself during this period, but again, like many of my other podcasts, it's putting the tools, practices, and the pillars in place so you can go and create something for yourself. I really enjoyed this podcast because it really gave me a step towards the future in terms of looking at how to build wealth for the future, not just in the short term. It's often misconstrued and it's often overlooked, especially for young people. So this was really helpful, really beneficial, and I really think you're going to enjoy it. Before we get going, if you could follow me on Spotify, that'd be pretty sweet. If you enjoy this podcast and you want to push it to Instagram or push it to LinkedIn, that would also be pretty cool. But I won't keep it any longer. Here's my conversation with Bernard Walsh. Bernard, you're very welcome. How are you doing?
Good, thanks, Darren.
Topic of discussion today is all around financial literacy, pensions, investing, just giving a good understanding, knowledge, improving people's like awareness and where to look amongst many other things. But before we kick off, give a little overview of your own background.
Like yourself, Darren, I'm a Corkman. I went to UCC quite a long time ago and did a BCom there and started working in branch banking, and I've worked in most aspects of financial services to date, but have kind of leaned more towards the whole investment and pensions arena for the last number of years, and have worked in the TSB and Barclays in Ulster Bank and in a number of different roles within Bank of Ireland as well. So today I am head of pensions and investments in Bank of Ireland Investment Markets.
Nice. Okay, you're going to be more and more qualified anyway than I would be to educate on this matter. But, you know, first I want to talk about is like financial literacy as a whole, just sure. Improving people's kind of knowledge and like essentially, you know, someone like yourself who's been through it, has good understanding, financial markets, just generating wealth as a whole. What do you think are some like kind of basic steps people can kind of use to improve their overall knowledge of managing their own capital and getting ready to kind of create a sustainable level of wealth over the next couple of years?
Yeah, I suppose if you look at financial literacy, and the term financial well-being is one that's used quite extensively nowadays today. And even in Bank of Ireland, we have financial well-being coaches now visiting schools and companies and so on to help people develop their understanding of their finances. And I suppose if you just take a step back and look at understanding your money, one of the areas that we have identified is that so many people in Ireland are stressed about their finances. And one of the things that maybe increases their level of stress is that they don't necessarily understand their own money. They don't understand what they have. And by, you know, spending a bit of time to learn about, you know, their money and what's the best thing to do with their money, how to handle debt, how to handle their bills and spending, once they get a better grip on it and better control on it, it gives them a huge level of freedom. And also it gives them a lot of confidence. So there's a, you know, there's a great phrase used that, you know, about financial planning, you know, is about being able to spend today with the confidence that tomorrow's being taken care of. And tomorrow's been taken care of is about the sort of the more the planning side of it. So financial literacy is about understanding your money, first of all, understanding what to do with it, second of all, and then just about having some good financial goals as well. So, you know, people, if you look, there's very few industries, or maybe there are, but I mean, the amount of jargon in our industry is extraordinary. And there's more three-letter abbreviations than you can imagine. And that can be quite off-putting for people. So, you know, one of the things that we try to do is try to demystify that, try and make it a bit more accessible to people. But there are a few simple steps that most people can take that it can really benefit them in the long run. But spending a bit of time, you know, if you get into some good habits about learning about money, they can pay very good dividends to you. And you'd be quite amazed, even a very simple thing. Listen to the business news on the radio every day. Some people, when they hear, you know, we'll go to today's business news, they tune out, might switch off. It's a really simple thing. Like there's business news on News Talk every morning at 6:30. It's really, really good. If that's a bit early for you, you can listen back to it later in the day. But it's a very good, they have a lot of different speakers on it. And it's a great way to kick off the day. A lot of people have smartphones. Most people do. If you've got tuned in radio, Bloomberg Radio is absolutely, you know, has terrific stuff on it and loads of ads, unless you're willing to pay for the premium version. That's a good thing to listen to. You know, in the evening, you know, on Matt Cooper's show on News Talk and on RT, you do have business shows as well. Like there's just lots of them on during the day, but it's about just sort of taking the 2 minutes here, the 5 minutes there. And bit by bit, that can really build up. And then you might find yourself taking an interest in looking at some of the financial websites that are out there. And there are many, many of those. And bit by bit, you're adding to your knowledge. And the more you add to your knowledge, the better you understand your own finances.
I think what happened with me as well was something similar. Was like trying to get a short bites of news that wasn't that long to consume, you know. So places like Goldman Sachs podcast, Morgan Stanley podcast were all short clips. It could be 3 to 5 minutes. They just give you updates on market news, give you that kind of general kind of awareness, which is what got me kind of like to my ear to the ground in terms of like what's happening. But then in terms of how it affected me, I think the best way to like how I learned how to like, well, it's not exactly like I've learned exactly how to do it, but the right plan was, you know, when I was trying to do something that would be expensive, whether it's traveling, whether it's saving for a car, whether it's saving for a big investment, then every time I've done it, I felt like I've improved on it. But I think if I didn't have a goal initially to work towards, it wouldn't have really happened. And that was kind of when I was quite young, you know, you could have started off when you're 16, 17, 18, and now at 24, 25, I want to try kind of build that up further. So do you think that's a big thing for people to do, is to kind of contribute towards a goal, maybe focus on that and then try to like improve how they learn and understand their wealth then?
It is something that does develop over time, but a part of it that will come to you as well, and a bit like what you just talked about there about goals and savings, is what we would call joined up thinking, that you can identify your goals, your own circumstances, and look at the investment world and try and plug them to get together in some way where you can see factors that are going on in the world at any time, and how they might impact ultimately on you, on your circumstances, and not just on your finances, but also maybe on your employer and in your work environment, and, you know, in the economy in which you're operating in.
Yeah, because people think that like, oh, your financial well-being is just how much money you're taking in, your income. But as you said, it's a multiple different factors. It's tax. It's like how we're going to repay all the COVID debt. You know, it's multiple different economic impacts. It's even interest rates, which is actually a kind of an area that I'd like to talk about as well. But it's kind of like that whole package that, okay, maybe you don't need to be fully invested in everything to understand it, but to have a general whereabouts is really important. So like, what do you think would be like where there's some gaps in people's knowledge when it comes to financial planning, just like at a basic level, like where are people kind of falling down on, do you think, where then it might come to someone like yourself and they've miss some kind of, you know, opportunities to be saving consistently over a couple of years?
I think that, you know, one of the first steps is just what you mentioned, is developing a good savings habit. And that is, you know, a lot of people, when their kids might have a piggy bank of some kind, or might get a savings account when they make their confirmation or communion and build up some money. And they can see the value of saving and having some targets for that money. I think, you know, the understanding your money is the first step that we talk to people about. So that is where you look at what you have and break it down into three boxes, three buckets, whatever you want to call them. The first being your day-to-day spending. Really understand your day-to-day spending. So how are you using your money? How are you spending money? And maybe this mightn't be the best time to measure it at the moment, because people are living from home. They're not going on holidays. They're not, you know, socializing probably to the extent that they normally would. But if you were to imagine, you know, three columns, and in each one of them that you have, how you spend. The second part would be how you, you know, what your goals for that money are. And then the third part would be where, what you might do with that money. So if your first one is what you use on the day-to-day basis, really you're putting that money in a current account, because your goals for that money are that you want it there, so that when you come to spend it, that it is there. You want it safe. Growth isn't really a priority for that money. It's just about having it there and then, but just having a good understanding of your day-to-day spending. And then your next box, which is more your medium term, you know, the 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, you know, you plan on going on a big holiday, or you might be buying your first house, or, you know, they're bigger expenditure items. But your priority there, again, it's probably a higher degree of security, reasonable level of access, and growth is still probably not the top priority for that money. And as well in that territory, the big one that we keep emphasizing to people, an emergency fund. Make sure you have an emergency fund. Everybody needs an emergency fund. An emergency fund is, you know, there are lots of different definitions of it, but it's, some people say, you know, that it's 6 months net earnings that you put aside. Others will say 3 months. But having a certain set amount of money, and I would always say to people, you know, carve that away from everything else that you've got. Don't you know, eat into it accidentally. Make sure that is money that you have, whether you put it in a different bank account or a different institution, whatever you go to do with it, make sure that it's separate. And then what you have over and above that, that is money that you don't need for the short term and the medium term. That's money you can look at trying to get a better return on that money and getting some growth on. So that's getting that growth on that money. So that's a different priority. Access is less a priority. It's not money you're looking at to use in the next year or 2 years. So you can have a different conversation about that money. So looking at different amounts, understanding my priority for this bucket is different to my priority for this bucket. And so your home for that money can be quite different as well.
Yeah, because like I think especially with the second and third stages there, in terms of like the emergency fund, people that are kind of my age, between 23 and maybe 27, never actually consider that. Even myself, you know, I actually would be number one in terms of understanding my current expenditure, and then number three in terms of like looking for the future. But I'd never really consider that middle ground whereby you could lose your job, you could get sick or whatever. So that alone is actually really valuable, because that is hard to get it to as well, you know, 2 to 3 months of your wages. But it is really valuable, you know. I think what's kind of interesting as well is the whole area around pensions. Like I know I mentioned to you earlier before we started, but like actually interesting story. So when I started my first job out of college, big corporation, you know, they gave us a talk about pensions at first, and they were like, okay, this is the boring part, you don't want to hear about it, but you should start putting away your pension, and here's a different pension scheme that we offer. But no one kind of understands the value of it when you're 23, 24, 25. They tell you that it's valuable, but you don't actually understand that it's kind of like the emergency fund. So like, even though it's kind of like people telling you to do correct things, you know, like to eat healthy, exercise, things like this, but some people don't really do it. You know, what's the kind of value you think for people that are just coming out of college to really get a head start and try to build up some sort of pension fund or some sort of understanding of it?
You know, if you were to imagine a normal environment, a pub full of 23, 24, 25-year-olds, and if I went in and stood up on the counter and I said, I have a stall over here on the side and I'm giving away free money, how do you think the reaction would be like?
Oh, jumping,
I think they would, and for a lot of people, that's what your pension is. That you have a lot of employers out there, particularly those that are working for, let's say, the more established employers. This is less, I suppose, a feature in the gig economy, and if you're self-employed, it's a different matter. But if you're working for a big employer, where you were asked to sit in the room for that talk, generally your employer is looking to put money into your retirement fund. So if you were to imagine, if you're saving, you know, you're putting in some money and your employer is putting in some money, that's free money. You know, you are, because you, and you, they're doing that because they want you to stay working for them. So that's the starting point I'd say to people. Make sure you get your free money. If your employer is offering, is giving you an opportunity to join, join, you know. Now, they may say to you that if you were, if they're going to put in some money, then you've got to put in some money. And that's, you know, that's not unreasonable. And that's quite typical in a lot of schemes. But, you know, the cost, you know, so in a lot of companies, they might say you put in 5% and we'll put in 5%. So you're getting 10. Yeah. You know, so you're getting 10% of what you're earning is put aside for your future. But you and I'll talk about tax relief maybe in a little while, but you know, you're getting a tax break on what you're putting aside. So your 5 isn't really costing you 5. It might be costing you 3. But if you were to imagine it's costing you 3 after tax, but you're getting 10. So again, if we go back to my mythical pub here, where I say, you know, I'm giving you some free money, but also I'm going to offer you a deal where you give me 3 and I'll give you 10. Well, would you take it? In a heartbeat. You know, so that is the, you know, and the other thing is that I'm saying to you is that I'll give you your 10 tax free. You know, would you take it? Again, you know, I think we'll still have a pretty good queue in this mythical pub as well. You know, so understanding the first thing I'd say to people about pensions is, you know, this is a very straightforward thing when you start at the 23, 24 age profile. The consequences of delay are huge. You know, and some people say, I want to, you know, enjoy life, so I'm not going to join the scheme. They might say, you know, I'm saving for a car, I might be saving for a house. And there's no doubt the cost of buying your first house is huge. But once people get on that pension saving journey, they find out very quickly that they get used to it. So they get used to that money not being there. And I know some people that when, you know, somebody recently who got a pay rise and they allocated their pay rise to their pension because they weren't used to getting this pay rise. So, you know, they said, right, they needed to catch up on a few years where they hadn't been saving. So, you know, it is just, you do get used to it. You get used to living without that money, but it's a good feeling when you see that pot accumulating over time. So like there is a carrot and stick here. There is the carrot of the incentive of someone giving you free money. There's the incentive of the government helping you with the tax breaks. There's also the stick, which is, you know, the state pension is 12 and a bit thousand euro per annum. But will that be around when you come to retirement? I'm not sure if it'll be around when I come to retirement. I think it's unlikely that it will be there to the extent that it is today. The OECD came in and said that the Irish pension system is utterly unsustainable. And you mentioned that the, you know, the cost of COVID earlier on and who's going to pay for COVID, like that's going to put increased strains on government finances as well. So like, there isn't a big pot of money waiting to pay your state pension there. So, you know, the responsibility may fall on you to actually fund for some more of that yourself. So that's really probably the more of the stick part of it.
I think even the way you described it there kind of just shows two things. It shows the, you know, the vulnerability of that pension system, and it could all go, it could all be moved around. We don't even know how that's going to be structured. But secondly, I think there's a genuine lack of education provided for people like my age on this, because even those different areas, okay, the scheme is fair enough. Like the company will match you. Hopefully they'll match you to the same percent. But I think a genuine understanding of like the different tax breaks, why it's applicable and how that money is actually worked is nearly more important, because like you explained there to me, the 10%, and I can see that value. That's often not really explained to people when they're kind of starting off these kind of pension schemes, you know, or Another area is how is that pension actually invested? So I saw my last pension, like there was like an interface and you go on and you could see, you were actually able to change where it was invested into. So slightly more volatile assets, slightly more, kind of more defensive, to be honest. You were able to take control of that. You know, what's your kind of approach towards managing your own pension? Would you encourage it, or would you think you should just stick with, if it's Irish Life or whatever, and let them manage it?
When I look at these things, the reality is that most people don't take an active approach to their own pension pot. And quite amazingly, if you think somebody who starts working in their mid-20s and works till they're 65, other than their family home, their pension pot could actually be their biggest financial asset. But they still take a very passive approach to it. And I don't mean passive in terms of passive investing. I mean, as in, what control that they have over it. They rely on others to make decisions for them. So the key thing is that how your money reflects you, it reflects your stage in life, it reflects your attitude to risk and what your priorities are when you want to retire and what level of growth, not just what level of growth you want, but what level of growth do you need? Because if you say, I want to retire at 55 or I want to retire at 60, well, who's going to pay for that? So maybe you might need more growth than the person who says, I'm comfortable to continue working well into my 60s. Interestingly, I suppose the most company pension schemes offer huge choice. You could have 10 or more different ways in which available to you to invest, and some more cautious than others. But most schemes have what's called a default strategy. So that is, if you don't make a selection, then this is picked for you. And it would be intended as the most generally appropriate one for most people. And in our experience, over 94% of people go with the default strategy and stay with it. So most people don't really make a decision on what happens to their money. They rely on the default strategy. And most cases, the default strategy is pretty good. And what a lot of them are what I call lifestyle strategies. What a lifestyle strategy does is, as you get near retirement, it de-risks your fund automatically. So when you're young, it targets maximizing growth because risk doesn't matter to the same extent when you're younger. As you get near retirement, risk becomes a bigger issue. But the key thing is, are people keeping in touch with it and ensuring that it is de-risking the way that is appropriate for them? And also, does it reflect the date when you intend to retire, or is it does it reflect a broader audience? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just think that exactly as you said, like I've seen those lifestyle pension funds and I didn't even understand them. So, you know, I think that's as well as like part of the issue. But it's quite interesting. You see though how it changes the risk profile. So you're saying the portfolio rebalances and will move into just defensive stocks or whatever they're doing. Well, it's probably just going to be fixed income at that stage.
Generally into fixed income, government bonds, whatever you should call them, you know, some corporate bonds and cash. That generally the direction it goes. But I suppose what we would say to people is, when you're looking at planning in this space, I say to people, begin with the end in mind. It's a famous line from Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Always start with the end in mind and then work your way back. And when we talk about the end, is not when you die. It is about when your working career ends. So how do you want to draw down your pension when you come to retire? And there's a lot of choice available to you. Do you want to buy an income that'll last you the rest of your life? Do you want a big pot of money? Do you want a lot of tax-free cash? Or a mixture of all three? And it's important that your money is managed to reflect all of that. And also what I just mentioned, when you actually want to retire. So that's the kind of conversation that people need to have. And most people only start having that as they get, as they kind of start seeing the finishing line in sight. We generally say that we do a lot of these pension clinics around the place. The audience falls into three categories, generally. There are those who have grey hair, those who have dyed hair, and those who have no hair. That tends to be the audience that we have, generally, people your age, Darren, will walk in, have a quick look at the screen and walk out again, unfortunately. Yeah. Whereas, if anything, you're the guys that should be probably paying most attention.
Yeah, like, because like that's my approach, is just to max out the shit out of these things, you know. And that brings on the next question, is about the optimal percentage of your salary to invest. Now, you know, like back to my earlier point about how, you know, we should do things the right way, but again, there has to be some sort of balance. So like for myself, these kind of tax-free, you know, kind of like schemes, I always try to avail of the most. Similar enough to what you said about the employee shares, you do get overexposure to a single equity, but you may get a 15% discount of the purchase price or something like this, you know. So those schemes are important for like building wealth, in my opinion. But back on the actual percentage, like, what would you recommend people as a general principle?
Good rule of thumb that I've seen is half your age as a percentage. So if you're 23, if you're 24 years of age, 12% of your salary is what you should be putting in. 12% of your annual salary. So 1 month, you know, 12% is a bit more, a month and a half of what you earn every year goes into your pension pot. You know, now that is the sort of the recommended amount. Now, remember, your employer is contributing as well to your retirement goals. So to me, that is the ideal that people should target. Now, you're looking at it for a 24-year-old. I mean, if you're to imagine if for a 50-year-old, you're talking 25% of their salary, you know, is what they potentially could be looking at. That will deliver somebody a very, very, very healthy income or lump sum at retirement, you know. But for most people, it is down to affordability. And what we would say to people is start with what you feel you can afford, get used to paying that, and then increase it by a set amount every year. So, you know, they try not to forget the importance of inflation. That inflation, you know, technically is non-existent in the world today, but it will come back at some point into the future. So it's a good idea to think, you know, I want to target, let's say if somebody today decides, you know, that they're earning 50,000 euro and they want to target retiring on 25,000 plus the state pension on top of that. But if your 25,000 is static, if that doesn't increase and the cost of living does increase, you know, you got to recognize that you need the value of what you're putting aside, what you're putting in is going up, as well as achieving some growth in the market as well.
Mm-hmm. That's why I raise an eyebrow, because, you know, people my age like will invest easily 10% or 12%. And like my friends do, we do chat around like inflation, but it's funny because they look at other assets, and if it's in equities, if it's in crypto, whatever, people do it because there's higher returns. So it's interesting you saying that, because over the longer period, your pension will give you back a better return. Does that make sense? Like if you're trying to, just, you know what I'm trying to say, my approach would be like, people will say, oh, it's just boring, you know, I'll forget about it, I'll worry about it, I'm 30. I'll start building a pension, I'm 30. But they will try to use that money when they're younger in other assets or other kind of ways of trying to generate income.
Well, look, I mean, if you said to one of your pals when you're having this conversation that, how would you like a 40% gain straight away on what you put aside? I'm sure they'd be quite attracted to that. But the reality is that's what they get, because even if your money goes into something very cautious, like a cash fund, you know, that isn't invested in the markets, the tax break, if you're a top rate taxpayer, so if you're earning, you know, 40 grand or more, you're paying top rate tax. And, you know, you're looking at straight away, you've got a 40% gain on your money just by availing of your tax break. You know, so you go off and you invest outside of a pension arrangement, you know, you're going to do well to get fined 40%. Now, you mentioned crypto, obviously, you know, you have days when that does spectacularly well. But I mean, I looked at just a quick look at the markets just before we came on here and saw that Bitcoin had dropped 16%. You know, you can just as quickly lose these you know, in a day as you can make in a day, you know. So it's just being conscious that the more high octane end of the game, you can make a lot of money, you can lose. And we saw that with GameStop recently. Mm-hmm. We've seen it with Tesla as well, you know, that some of these, you know, and within 24 hours, two of the biggest investment banks in the world commented on Tesla. One said that it was the biggest bubble since Dutch tulips, and the other said that it could grow 50-fold. Now, take your pick as to which one of those is right. But I would suggest for people are looking at their pension fund is to view it a bit differently to buying direct shares themselves and buying direct investments. You're probably looking for more the marathon runner than the sprinter. And like you're probably looking for something that's going to clock regular solid times and deliver decent returns, bearing in mind you've got a 40% uplift already. And if your employer is putting into it, you've got even more again.
One last question on the pensions is around tax. Now, even like my mother herself, I think she's retiring pretty soon, and I was trying to look at her tax for her and look at her pension, and I couldn't even make heads or tails of it. It was like a state pension, and I was trying to figure it out in my own head. Now, it's so funny because this is like 40 years on, but again, having this kind of foresight, what's the story with, you know, tax in general for pulling out your pension in terms of lump sum? I'm not too sure what actually happens, to be honest.
Okay. If I say, you know, the first piece of advice that I would always give is never, ever, ever give advice to any member of your own family ever about anything to do with money. Once you get over that one, just when you look at pensions, just the core things, and there's a book as thick as you like with all the rules and regulations, but at its most basic, when you put money into your pension fund, you get a tax relief on it. So what that means is that you get tax relief depending on what rate of tax you pay. So if you're a top rate, you're paying 40% tax on some of it. I'm looking mainly at your PAY earners here. You know, there's all kinds of other rules for if you're company directors and so on, self-employed. But look, at its most basic, you put in 10 grand into a pension fund, you know, you will get a tax relief of 4,000 of that. So you've 10 grand in your pension, and it's cost you, after tax, it's cost you 6. Okay, so you've invested your 10,000 euro. You put that money in there, and let's say you leave it there till you retire, it grows tax-free. So if you were to think of all, you know, other ways of investing where you might earn dividends, or you might see the capital value of the assets going up, you've got to pay capital gains tax, all those things, none of those apply to your pension. So it grows tax-free. And that over time is a very, very valuable, you know, tax asset to have as well. When you reach retirement, you can draw down some of your money in tax-free. You can effectively draw down up to 200,000 euro. Now, you obviously must have over 200,000 euro in your pot. And again, there's lots of rules and regulations around the length of service that you've done in the company and so on, and what you were earning. But effectively, you can draw down 200,000 tax-free, and you can draw down more money again and pay only 20% tax on that sum. And then if you want to draw down more of that money, you will pay tax at the highest rate. But for a lot of people, what they will end up with is they'll end up drawing down a lot of money tax-free, and then they'll pay some tax on the remainder as they draw down, whether by an income or taking money out of a fund. The big things are tax break on the way in, grows tax-free, and you can take out a lot of it tax-free. Those are the key. But as I said, you know, do you want all the disclaimers in the world? Rules and regulations apply. Read if you're having trouble sleeping, there are some brilliant technical manuals that will explain all the ins and outs of this to you.
Start a YouTube channel. Go to and explain all of them. That's perfect. I think, like, again, people just don't have the idea of it at first when they're doing it, and having some sort of awareness is actually always good. Next area here I want to chat about was around the investing side of it. So kind of the third stage of what you mentioned earlier in terms of like your financial planning. You know, I've kind of found myself, like you said, when, you know, you're doing nothing in a lockdown, can't spend your money. I call them the Saturday night expenditures have removed. So I've like kind of put my head up and tried to be look around in terms of sensible, you know, logical investing that was going to be sustained. And I think the big thing around here, what I wanted to do was like build something that was sustainable, kind of like your pension fund over years and years. So if it's an ETF, it's an index fund, if it's something, but just having a strategy and a structure. What would your approach be to someone quite young who does have disposable income that doesn't want to spend it on something stupid and wants to make it work but not also leaves himself overexposed?
I suppose let's look at the starting point here. I'm going to assume it's somebody younger that doesn't have a big lump sum accumulated. Mm-hmm. If they do, they've used some of it for their emergency fund we mentioned already. So let's look at what you talked about there, which is disposable income or excess earnings, if you want to call it that. So really what you're looking at there is a regular savings strategy. And that's something that can work really well. We use a term called euro cost averaging. Now, what that means is that, just take 2020 as a prime example. So if, let's say, you were putting in, let's say, 200 euro a month at the end of every month, right throughout 2020, then let's say you were putting it into, and this would be quite common, there are lots of different ways you can do this. But for a lot of people, let's say somebody who's relatively young, they can afford to take some degree of risk because they, you know, their attitude to risk might allow. They take the person putting some money in January, they put in 200 euro in January. Middle of February, the COVID crisis moved from the east to the west. Stock markets had their sharpest sell-off of all time. So the money that you put in at the end of January is now worth substantially less because we've had this really sharp downward spike in markets. But then you're in this strategy where you're buying in at the end of every month. So even though we're in the middle of a crisis, the end of February, you're also buying in as well. And you're buying the same types of assets, but they're much, much cheaper. They're selling, and you're probably wondering, well, should I continue to buy? But you've agreed on a strategy, so you're going to stick to that. Then the end of March, markets have maybe stopped falling sharply, maybe a bit of up and down a bit, so you're buying some more again. But again, they're quite cheap. It's the end of April now, and markets, the central banks all over the world have got together and said, we're going to stimulate the economy. You know, the Jay Powell, the head of the US Federal Reserve, has said, we're going to do what it takes to get the US economy going again. Europe has said the same, and we start to see stock markets start to bounce back up. And as they started to move back up during April, so you bought some at the end of April when they were on the way up, and at the end of May, they're on the way up again. So all of a sudden, what you bought in February is now worth an awful lot more. But what you bought in January might still be a bit below water, but by the summertime, it's got back up again. So what you're doing is you're buying in through the good days and the bad days on the basis that over time, that investing in a well-diversified, a good mix. So you're investing in a portfolio that's some shares, some bonds, maybe some property, some other assets in there as well, but they will move up and down. It will, you know, you're buying in over time, because you believe that most growth will come from investing in well-run companies and in good governments. So that's effectively what you're doing. So that sort of that approach of having that good mix is really important. But what I mentioned there was having the mix, but what is the right mix for you? So this is what we call attitude to risk. And there's always this trade-off. And the trade-off is one that has been there since the foundation of time, the trade-off between risk and reward. So what level of risk am I willing to take? And if you want, you can go back to Stone Age times when the hunters went out to look for food, and they were willing to take some risk to get some food out there, and they developed the instincts of fight or flight or freeze, the third one that doesn't get referred to as much. And the freeze one is really important when it comes to investing, that at times, like we saw in February, March of last year, that you know it's time to freeze, not freeze but your money, but freeze your actions. And we often use the phrase, don't just do something, stand there, which is the opposite of what you were probably told in school, to do something. But this is when the importance of actually staying put. The blend and the mix of how much you have in shares and how much you have in bonds should reflect you and your circumstances and your outlook. And some people are more cautious than others. So you might have somebody who's cautious might say, I don't want any more than, let's say, 33% in shares, and then some of the rest in other assets. Whereas others that might be interested in something with more opportunity for growth might be willing at 60, 70, even 100% invested in growth assets. And what you would have seen last year is the more cautiously managed approach served well during March and April, But over the full year, the more active approach with a higher level of exposure to growth assets delivered the best outcome. So, but there are periods when one might do better than others, but it's what's right for you. And, you know, it's really important that people have that sleep at night factor. You don't want people lying awake worried about these assets. It is making sure that you're taking a sensible decision and that you have a good long-term strategy. This is not something for 12 months. This is something, you know, this is 5 years plus is generally what we're talking about as the horizon here.
And, you know, like you touched on loads of great points, especially around risk and understanding like your appetite to risk and what's the right mix for you. What do you think like about when you're just starting out and you're just kind of like building a portfolio? So you're looking at ETFs, maybe looking at index funds, and you're trying to find out what kind of suits you right and what's right for your strategy. How do you think you should kind of maybe like analyze different asset classes? Like, how would you approach that? Because instead of just jumping in like Tesla at the very top, which obviously isn't like a encouraged kind of approach, but maybe like analyzing macro views, looking at different, I don't know, interest rates, different approaches, and making a well-educated, informed decision then.
I suppose, and again, it's, you know, the most straightforward approach is if you want to talk about ETFs or talk about funds or index funds, is looking at a global basket. Because if you have a well-diversified international basket of shares, then you're going to have, you'll have some Tesla and you'll have the FANGs, the Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Googles. But you may also have the Pfizers there that all of a sudden, you know, made that incredible announcement last November, and then its share price powers ahead from there. You might have the Johnson & Johnson in there that is steadily, solidly producing really good returns. You know, you look at a company like Unilever, you know, in there that continues to sell, you know, Hellmann's mayonnaise or Calippo ice cream every single day of the week. 160 million times a day somebody buys one of their products. You know, so it's trying to, you know, Unilever might sound boring, but it has a role to play in your portfolio, you know, and you know, the companies that have some defensive characteristics can play an important role when markets become a bit more nervous or a bit more turbulent, or you have an economic downturn. And this is back to the monitoring of what you have, that, you know, the interest rate climate, you know, has been very benign, very low for a long time. As that changes, that has quite an impact on what type of stocks will do well at different times. And so that's why it's important that you're looking at what you have and that you're monitoring the mix that you have. But generally, I would say, if you're young and you want growth, you know, a simple global equity ETF, a simple global equity index fund, you know, will for the majority of your money. So this is what we sometimes call a core satellite approach, that you might decide I'm going to have my core being that sort of really well diversified basket, but I'm going to allocate 10% into something that has, it might be a theme that you are a big fan of, let's say alternative energy or water technology is one that we would see a lot of interest in from clients at the moment. It might be a theme that reflects some of your own personal beliefs that might have a greater reflection of things like ESG, which is environmental, social, and governance issues, or it might be an industry theme such as, you know, technology shares that you want to beef up. So, you know, but have a core, and then if you want to mix around different satellites around that as well, you know, isn't a bad strategy.
I think, yeah, that's, I completely agree, because even from my own perspective, it's about like having a strategy, but that isn't overly exposed to certain areas. So like if you said they're ESG, and if it's like a hydrogen stock, that company might come in and out. But if the ETF is well balanced across multiple different companies, across the mineral itself, the commodity itself, you kind of get the benefit, but none of the drawbacks, but you're just less exposed. And then you can open yourself up to maybe more percentage of your portfolio. So that's why 10% is a good kind of approach. That's kind of what I was kind of like kind of moving towards, was having 30-40% in cash, trying to rebalance everything else then quite evenly and not be left hole in the bag, really, when things take a bit of a turn.
You know, some people, when it comes to rebalancing, just be careful that you don't get caught, you know, out of the markets, you know, for the money that you want invested. Because we've seen time and time again, people who get nervous or people who want to, let's say, dial down risk a bit because they're listening to the wrong things on the news or reading the wrong things on the papers, they can often miss some spectacular growth. So if you were to take even last year, again, the example, you know, February, March, if you stepped out of the markets after the fall, you've missed all the rebound. You know, so you suffered the downside without managing to take advantage of the upside.
And do you think that's based off emotional trading and making decisions? So in, like moving away from their strategy, would you say that's a big idea there, or else it's fear of missing out?
It is your money, you know, so people can, you know, you do see all of the seven deadly sins at play when it comes to how people look after their money. They become envious of the friend who invested in Tesla at $2 a share, or they, you know, they bought, you know, somebody who down the road who bought Bitcoin at $50. You know, that you know, usually they say that most people, you know, see a bandwagon from behind. And, you know, by the time you do catch up with it, it's generally too late. So stick with what's right for you. I mean, I saw data just on the US market, just as a prime example. If you left your money there over a long, long period of time, just over 30 years, then per annum return was about 8.5% a year. But if you missed the best 25 days over that same period, your growth was 3.33% a year. So that's a huge gap between the two. But if you compound that up in terms of somebody who put aside, let's say, $50,000 into the market, like the difference between staying put and missing those 25 days is about $400,000 in the gap over that time period. You know, so it just emphasizes again, you know, there are a number of cardinal rules, but one of them is, you know, just allow time to do what it's meant to do. You know, put it there and let it grow and you know, monitor it, make sure it still reflects your circumstances because, you know, you're talking as, you know, someone in their mid-20s, you know, roll the clock forward when, you know, you're running your own business or, you know, you've maybe married with kids or you've got a mortgage or, you know, people's circumstances change over time. And, you know, similar, you know, if your circumstances change or the market changes, you know, you need to be able to adapt what you have to reflect those circumstances as well.
Last question is, I want to ask you is, where can people look to kind of improve their financial knowledge of investing? Like, where would you recommend people to go to? Would it be a book, online resource? What's your kind of first steps?
You know, I mentioned one earlier on, which is, you know, just reading the business pages in the newspapers and listening to the business news on the radio. I think those are quite useful ones. There's huge amounts, whether you look at in terms of online resources, whether, you know, the Investopedia is a terrific resource with so much there. Motley Fool is a UK website, motleyfool.co.uk. A huge amount of information in there as well. Obviously, I would point people in the direction of Bank of Ireland, and we have a lot of content there that will hopefully help people on their investment journey as well. Advice plays a really important role here. Speak to people who've been through a few cycles, who know how the markets work, can be very beneficial to you. But there's a world of resources out there. There's lots of apps that you can use to keep an eye on what's going on in the markets. There's one called Teletrader. It's a free app. It just gives you a great snapshot of what's happening in the market today. But it's just one of these things that you accumulate over time. If your employer has organized a talk and people are coming in to speak to you as employee, to your listeners as employees, it's only half an hour of your time and it can be the most valuable half hour that you can spend. So it's about investing in yourself, you know, is the first step, and giving yourself time to understand. Don't be put off by the jargon. Remember, people can talk about shares and stock markets, equities, all these things. All you're doing is buying a company. you are buying a portion of that company and you are participating in if that company is successful. If you're buying into a fund that holds property, you are buying a piece of different buildings and you're getting some of the rent. You're getting some of the growth and the value of those assets. So it is just trying to bring it back into what's important to you and what's most relevant in your life.
Thank you very much, Bernard. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Darren.
And there we have it for yet another episode. I want to say a massive thank you to Bernard again. This was really, really helpful for myself, for everyone listening. I think it was something that people don't necessarily think about a lot of the time. So sitting down with Bernard, getting his expertise, getting all of his insights and his perspective was really helpful for myself and hopefully helpful for you too. I'm going to leave it here, but if you enjoy this podcast and if you want to push it out to Instagram, push it out to LinkedIn, that would be sweet. If you also just want to drop me a follow on Spotify, that would be pretty cool too. But I'm going to leave you here. I'll see you in episode 32. Thank you for listening.